Hey friend, welcome to part two of Decoding Food Addiction with Dr. Wyss. If you did not tune in last week, you're gonna wanna pause right now and go start with last week's episode. This is a two-part series. It was just over an hour interview, and because it was so good, I wanted to break it up over into two episodes. So if you start here, you're gonna be starting mid-conversation, and it's just not going to do this topic justice. So if you hadn't tuned in last week, pause it, go jump into last week's episode. If you already did, welcome back. I'm so glad you're here. We are going to break this down even farther and talk about what you can do with some of this anti-diet, diet culture rhetoric and how we can make it applicable to you and be open to some of the science that is out there. In particular, we are talking about something called food addiction. And I love how Dr. Wyss actually reframes this. He doesn't like the word food addict or food addiction, because it can put people in this very vulnerable spot. And I've seen that when we use that word in sessions with clients, it makes us feel powerless. Because if you think about addiction and the addictive model, the goal is to remove the addictive substance entirely. And we just can't do that with food. We can do it with alcohol, but to say I'm addicted to sugar so I can never eat sugar again is a really, really difficult thing to do. And honestly, not necessary. You'll hear us break this down a little bit more in the conversation today, but I wanted to give you guys an example of how this information can be used in an empowered way. So I have a specific food that definitely releases this mega dose of dopamine in my brain. I can feel it. I feel out of control when I eat it, but at the same time, I love it and I don't want to stop. And it is the favorite red Starburst jelly beans. If you've ever had these, you probably know what I'm talking about. Every year between Valentine's Day and Easter, Starburst comes out with these fave red jelly beans, and they are, oh my gosh, I could down the entire bag. I don't care what my biofeedback says, where I feel my blood sugar spiking and I feel crappy. I just love these jelly beans. And when I eat them, I can feel out of control. So when I first started eating these jelly beans, what I noticed is I would have them in my car and I would eat them from the transition from like work to picking up my kids. It was like this treat. I loved having them. I looked forward to having them. The thought of taking them out of my car was something that just like made me anxious and I didn't want to do it. So as I learned more about food addiction and this dopamine release, I was able to break it down in an empowered way. So if I think about it from a biofeedback standpoint, I eat these jelly beans and while they taste really good in my mouth, they don't feel good. Like I can feel the blood sugar spike. But in the moment, the reality is the override of dopamine in my brain from this level of sugar makes me not care. Like I just don't care. If I break it down even farther and look at it from a hunger standpoint, I'm not truly hungry in this moment. I'm actually just eating these jelly beans because I'm looking for something to kind of like lift my spirits as I transition from work to pick up the kids. It's like I pour myself out at work and then I pick up the kids and I'm pouring myself out towards the kids. I was looking for something to fill my own cup in that short drive between work and grabbing the kids. Now, as an empowered eater, I know myself really well. And if I tell myself, no, you cannot have those jelly beans, Jess, those are off the table because they're addictive or they're something that make you eat too many of them. If I get into that narrative, I know myself, I'm going to want those jelly beans. And then I'm going to crave the jelly beans. And then I'm going to obsess about the jelly beans. And if I don't actually get the jelly beans, I'm going to end up eating something else later in the day. I know this about myself. So what I've decided to do is when I get these jelly beans, I pack myself a mini bag instead of taking the whole thing in my car. I know I'm looking for a sweet treat to transition myself between work and picking up the kids. And sometimes I really like having those red jelly beans. I don't do this every day. I do it in February because that's when they come out. And I give myself permission to do that. What's funny is as soon as I gave myself permission to have this food and I recognized it for the actual need it was meeting. So the jelly beans were not meeting a hunger need. They were meeting an emotional need. And at the same time, I understood the science behind what was happening in my brain when I have this sort of food. So I put a healthy boundary around it. I pre-portioned those jelly beans so that I could have them without self-sabotaging. When I did this, it was crazy. I stopped overeating the jelly beans. I actually just ate them when I wanted them. I enjoyed them. They were a treat. And then other times I forgot about the jelly beans and I was fine not having them. It's amazing what our perception can do and how it can influence how we decide or don't decide not to have some of these foods. This is what I want for you today as we're breaking down this idea of food addiction. If you have certain foods that you feel you eat out of control, instead of saying, I am addicted to these foods, I can't ever have them, I really want to invite you to think of how you may integrate them or set up boundaries in a way that is productive for you, in a way that is empowering and leaves you at the end of the day feeling in control of what you're eating and in the driver's seat. Because ultimately, you are in the driver's seat. And when we can leverage nutrition science and biofeedback, looking at that through the lens of our values, our experience, and our story, we can maintain that position of feeling in control of what we're eating. I'm so here for that. That's what we're here to do. All right, let's go ahead and dive into the second half of this interview with Dr. Wiss.
Hey, I am Jess, and I'm obsessed with all things nutrition, science, and helping you navigate this information while maintaining a deep sense of peace and empowerment in your body. I'm a registered dietitian who started out with an eating disorder and then fell in love with learning about how God intricately designed our bodies to be resilient and so much more than superficially beautiful. I am now a mama who loves to be healthy, not because of how it makes me look, but because of how it has transformed the energy I can give to my family, my friends, and you. On this show, we hit on real talk around the latest nutrition science and body image resiliency, all while balancing it between grit and grace. Think of this as your weekly audio copy to encourage your empowered eating journey. This is the Fuel Her Awesome podcast.
For those that are listening, how are you moving forward with this information of the dopamine release that is associated with ultra processed foods? Like, how are you moving forward with that in the clients that you're working with?
Yeah. So there's a way to be super food positive and move people toward eating food, right? That resembles nature, that lands well on the gut, and that registers well by the brain. Right. And there's a way to get people to do that without being punitive and to do it in a fashion that doesn't feel disordered or doesn't promote diet culture. And that's going to vary from person to person, you know?
Yeah.
One of the big things that I try to do in my practice, and, you know, I've written about it. I've launched an app that sort of addresses it in some ways called Wise Mind Nutrition, is thinking about how cognitively rigid someone is versus how cognitively flexible someone is, right? This tendency to like creating rules versus principles, et cetera. And, you know, the dopamine response from food is a perfect example of where someone might be super inclined to rule-based rigid approaches. Like, oh, if this is true and these things activate reward, then I want to do none of it. And, you know, a lot of that is the only way forward for some people, especially if someone actually has an addictive disorder. They're more likely to have trauma and they're more likely to have cognitive rigidity, right? They're more likely to have black and white thinking, right? And so someone might gravitate toward, you know, a very rigid approach to a food when they might actually benefit from a little bit less structure, right? And this could be something that is done in these 50-minute sessions. It's like talking through someone's cognitive processes around food, the decision making, and all of the other factors, and the energy, and the CBT, the cognitive processes, the behavior, right? All of those pieces. And yeah, there's a way to move people into eating more like category one, NOVA classification. These are called minimally processed or unprocessed foods without being triggering at all. So you're not, it's not about, you know, what the harms of foods. It's not about you should be scared. It's that you should be excited about what's in these other foods. You know what I mean?
And yeah.
If someone hasn't eaten a lot of salads and they really want to start eating more vegetables, and the way forward, because let's be honest, like conceptually, like you or I can be like, yeah, make this big thing with radishes and bell peppers in it. Like, it's great. You know, I love it. Right. Like that food does not land well on a lot of people. It doesn't elicit a dopamine response. It doesn't settle well in the gut. There's aversive reactions that occur, like from the sight, the smell, the initial texture in the mouth, right? There are people that really struggle with those foods. And if it was helpful to crunch up a bag of Doritos and to pour that on the salad and to start there, right? Yeah. Like I would be in favor of that approach, right?
Yeah.
So there's also a way to leverage the dopamine response from food, right? To help someone, you know, move into new areas of eating and just to bring it into the model. I think the classic eating disorder model tried to remove any of that, right? By normalizing, neutralizing all foods, right? A calorie is a calorie, right? And the classic eating disorder model kind of ignores the neurobiology and the reward of eating. And all we're saying, all I'm saying is let's do all that awesome work that we've been doing and also acknowledge the neurobiological impact of these foods, right?
Yeah,
which are dopaminergic, sometimes, you know, overly stimulating, sometimes overly rewarding, sometimes addiction-like, sometimes addicting, and sometimes like a very serious problem for some people. So we introduce this continuum of possibilities. And here's where it gets really good. The context of it all matters. Someone could move from some of those different phases in different periods of their life based on all the other factors that are going on in their life, right? Like eating a cookie by yourself after a really hard day might be different from eating a cookie with your loved one in a park, you know, with the sun hitting your face. And these are all things that we eating disorder dietitians know, right? But when you can message this and message the dopaminergic response from foods and bring them all together in a more comprehensive model, you're not missing components that lead to very biased perspectives about human eating behavior.
I love that. So you're talking about, I love that, leveraging the dopamine response. So understanding what gives you the dopamine response and then figuring out how do we infiltrate this into what we're doing. So what do you think then about, because one of the things that I, in my training was like, people with anorexia or bulimia, more so anorexia, they don't have a dopamine response when they eat a lot of food. Like they actually have the reverse, right? Where they don't feel that hedonic pleasure when eating food. So what sort of like leverage, you know, dopamine leveraging do you do there?
Yeah. And many of those actually get a rewarding response from the opposite,
right?
Right.
Not
from
eating.
This sort of starvation. Quick side note, and then I'll try to come back to that. You know, we've assumed that because the overlap, interestingly, between ultra processed food addiction symptoms and anorexia nervosa restrictive type is like alarmingly high, right?
Yes.
And it's like, this is like one of the really baffling parts for this type of research. And myself and others have scratched our head and tried to like come up with explanations why some people that have, you know, underweight anorexia, right, would be scoring so high on the Yale food addiction scale. And, you know, there's a couple reasons. One is that they could be truly just underfed, underweight, restrictive, and they're perceiving all of this food addiction, right? It's like, you know, it's like, do you lose control when you eat? It's like, yes.
Yeah.
Right? It's a self-reported tool, right? So it is a skewed perception of food addiction symptoms, right? Which is one explanation. But another one, which I think is valuable that a lot of people haven't thought about, is that there are some people that are in a very highly restrictive eating disorder, perhaps even anorexia nervosa, more likely to be a binge purge type or someone that has bulimia nervosa, that have a strong neurochemical response to foods, a strong dopaminergic response to foods. And it's so much that it becomes aversive, right?
Oh, interesting.
And so that they were, there's the originally restrictive and then there's the originally addictive, right? And that they actually develop their restrictive eating disorders in response to the ultra processed food addiction.
Wow. Interesting.
So rewarding that it's like, I can't deal with this.
I can't handle this.
Can't handle this. This is changing my body. I'm going to do none of it. Right. And then of course, by doing none of it, it even heightens the reward response to it.
Right.
So it's even more stimulating. Right. But yeah, I would say that even with something like anorexia nervosa restrictive type, that there's phenotypes in there.
Yeah.
Right. That there's different sort of presentations. And that, you know, it could be that some of those individuals after restraining from those foods, right, the dopamine response really does change. But yeah, contextual factors matter a lot, you know, who is the person eating with, and right, like, you know, what are the relational dynamics at play? And that's why we are so important as, you know, clinicians, like, to actually eat with our clients sometimes.
Right, right. Well, and break it down and explain this to them. I mean, even hearing you say that, I'm thinking of, you know, folks I'm walking with in this journey right now. And like, that might actually be really freeing for them to hear that they feel this fear and loss of control because something is happening in their brain. Yes. And I think before, our training was like, no, just eat the food anyway. You'll eventually not be afraid of it because you eat more of it and then it loses its power. Like, it was very like superficial. And now if we dive deeper, it actually explains a lot. And that's our body's biofeedback and mechanisms and understanding it. I think there's a lot of power in that.
Yeah. You let someone know that there's not a single explanation for this. It's not unidimensional. These are multidimensional problems. And if you offer someone an explanation that like lands a little bit more as true, right? Because in the classic eating disorder model, there's like this still persistent assumption that all of it comes from body image, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's like, it's not always true. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that myth, I think, is pushed on people. And like, is body image a part of the picture? Usually. Is it a big part of the picture? Yeah. A lot of times it is a driver, right? Mm-hmm. It's a huge part of the picture, but it's not the only part of the picture, right? And so when you ignore neurochemistry and the biological mechanisms and you're just focused on the, you know, psychosocial influences and the media and the social media, people feel invalidated because they're mm-hmm. like, yeah, that stuff. Yeah, that's all stuff. Yeah, I unfollowed the accounts, but I still have this. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so when you can offer someone an explanation of like, yeah, these foods might actually, you know, to say to someone, for example, you know, I noticed that, you know, you have a lot, there's alcoholism on your mom's side of the family, mm-hmm. right? And I understand that you had a lot of adversity early in life that was biologically embedded. When people have a history of reward dysfunction genetically through the germline and trauma and everything you've been through, it would make sense to me that some of these foods would be super, super stimulating to you.
Yeah.
And then it would also make sense to me why you would, you know, work really hard to avoid them. And it makes sense to me why you got where you are now, right? Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. not an easy thing to get out of. But we can do it together one bite at a time and let's figure out what that's going to look like for you. It's way more validating.
Oh yeah. That's so much more validating than saying like, yeah, you just need to go ahead and eat it anyways. That's like, right. Which is where I've really run into problems in this realm. And that's been like the model thus far, is like forcing them to just exposure therapy, eat the food, even though you're afraid, without the explanation of why they might be afraid and just chalking it up to body image. Oh, that's so much more freeing and enlightening. And I love that it's pulling on the science, because that's what we got into this field for in the first place, was to understand nutrition science.
And yeah, I think we nailed it, is that, you know, and I'm proud to be an eating disorder dietitian. I know that maybe I've come off a little bit critical today of the field, you know, and I am. I write about it and I talk about it. And it's really because I want us to lift up and, you know, really come to terms with this idea that there are a lot of other models out there mm-hmm. that are missing from the picture. And part of that is because the original models for eating disorders were created for a very specific mm-hmm. type of eating disorder. You know what I mean? That happens to be life-threatening.
Oh, that's so true. Yeah.
You know what I'm
yeah.
saying? So like, we built these models for a very specific phenotype of eating disorders. And then as time goes by, there's all these newer presentations that are trauma-based, addiction-based, and all these, this broader range. And as there was more heterogeneity in disordered eating, there wasn't more variation in the models. And mm-hmm. that's what has created these problems we're in, is that we need updated models. We need more science. And, you mm-hmm. know, the work that I'm trying to do is to bridge the gap between the addiction like eating world and the restriction like eating world mm-hmm. and to try to figure out how do we create comprehensive models. And the problem with it is that in my experience thus far, working one-on-one with people and supervising dietitians and trying to train people, mm-hmm. I don't think that, because this is so complex and so dialectical and so it requires such a level of nuance. I don't really see us being able to discern between these different presentations just from screening tools or from manualized therapy. Mm-hmm. It does absolutely require a level of clinical intuition mm-hmm. that I think a lot of people, especially if you don't have any history with mental health, addiction, trauma, eating disorders, might feel really uncomfortable about, right? Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. so what a lot of times, a lot of the issues we've talked about today stems from, you know, like for example, a well-intentioned model where you get a young dietitian, maybe there was an eating disorder and there's some personal bias about how things yeah. should be, or maybe there's not at all, but they go through like a training program and they get mm-hmm. certified, right? And they work in a treatment center and they're like exposed to a model that they're mm-hmm. given, right? And kind of don't use their own clinical intuition as much as, you know, kind of adhering to mm-hmm. what is socially acceptable. So we need dietitians to, because I don't believe that there's going to be, you know, adequate mental health training in the dietetic curriculum, you know, soon enough, right? Yeah. Mental health professionals are moving into nutrition way faster than nutrition people are moving into mental health, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
yeah, unfortunately. So yeah, there's a need for dietitians to seek your own training mm-hmm. in a lot of these other topics we're discussing. Nutrition for depression, nutrition for substance use disorder, nutritional oh, yeah. psychiatry, nutritional psychology. If you want to work in mental health, we need functional medicine. We need all we of need these it. Pieces and to bring them all together to have more comprehensive models of understanding people and essentially being able to help them.
Absolutely. Well, and going back to like what we started with is like, we're missing, not including this, we're missing a huge piece of the puzzle. And I think the data is coming out. Like one of the coolest studies I've read in the last year was they actually compared social, I can't remember the name of the study, but they were looking at a dietary intervention for depression versus social supported intervention, essentially like a group therapy setting.
Yep, yep.
And the nutrition intervention had greater outcomes in depression reduction. And so I'm kind of looking at this going, nutrition is just as valid in treating anxiety and depression as exercises. Like we've right. already paved that path. And that's nutrition right. plays this role. And if we don't bring this in to our eating disorder treatment, we're missing a piece. And I think, you know, I do really try to not put my stuff on other people. And like with the model I work on, I let them set the values and the tones, but I'd be lying if I didn't say like my journey has impacted this. And I personally have gone through recovery. And then I've gone through more of the intuitive eating model for years. I lived that way. And then I kind of had this aha moment after my first son was born and I was a working mom and I was like, I can't eat intuitively anymore. Like I feel like crap. And the benefits I felt from moving into this more like this balanced of intentionality, of having discipline, but maintaining cognitive flexibility has been so life-giving. And I, you know, I feel so great. I'm getting ready to turn 40 and I feel fantastic. And I can't like go on anymore not sharing that with people because I think it's really validating and really helpful information to know. We got to share it.
And the criticism that I would offer about the, you know, intuitive eating perspective is that the, you know, some of the gatekeepers there would hear what you just said and say, oh, well, you're oh, just for sure. not doing it right.
For sure.
You're just not doing it right. So that's mm-hmm. where I'm as a scientist, I'm like, oh, so you're saying you have a perfect model that mm-hmm. everyone should fit in. And if they don't fit in it, they're not doing it right. Right. As opposed to this is a model. And there are several others, right? Mm-hmm. One mm-hmm. of the most profound things I learned in statistics was that all models are wrong, but some mm-hmm. of them are useful, right? So we yeah. just look for things that we can grab from different models, study from different teachers, and bring it all together for our own lives and for the people that we're trying to have an impact on.
Oh, absolutely. Well, David, I am so grateful for the work you're doing. Thank you for taking some darts in our field and being willing to start this conversation, open these doors. I'm just now like walking into this. I just dropped a 2-part series on like intuitive versus impulsive eating where I interviewed one of my colleagues. She's a psychologist, great mind. And it was really interesting. We dove into some of that about yes. how the model might not work for everyone, and that's okay. And even that I think is freeing, not to go off on a whole nother tangent, but I think intuitive eating has become the Prince Charming of the recovery world. And for some people, like, that's not the model that's going to save them. And then they feel like a failure if they can't eat intuitively. So anyways, I really appreciate the work you're doing, and that you don't have a food philosophy. You're here to be curious and learn. So super grateful. And thank you for your time today.
You're so welcome. And there's so much optimism that I have right now, just from talking to you and being able to see how we can move forward as a field and really join forces rather than keep fighting each other.
Yes. Yes. Now you have an awesome app called the Wise Mind app. Yes. So just real quick, tell people about what this is all about and how they can find it and what they can get out of using it.
It's called Wise Mind Nutrition. Three words, and it's not my last name. It's Wise as in Wise Mind from Dialectical Behavioral Therapy. And it's really designed to just bridge the gap between these sort of polarized ways of thinking and ways of being. So it's fully flexible to meet the needs of a person with a history of restriction. It's food positive. There's no rules. So someone that was on an eating disorder recovery could come in, log their food, share it with their provider, watch some modules, do some reading, get some recipes, get some meditations, some cooking lessons. Like, it's a very robust app that basically captures the experience of working with me for 6 months. And, you know, all for less than the cost of 10 minutes of chatting with you, right?
Yeah.
So it's definitely made for people that either don't want to do one-on-one work, can't afford it, or want to use it alongside one-on-one work with a coach or provider. So you can share your food logs with someone you're working with, or with a friend, or with a family member. So there's a really awesome connect feature that allows for people to share journaling if they want. You can pick what you share and what you don't. But it's also made for the person that has depression or ultra processed food addiction. There's personalized messaging based on the mental health scores.
That's awesome.
So when you come in and I kind of learn a little bit about you and figure out like what might be some of the more indicated topics, right? Mm-hmm. And what might I be able to highlight and point to if someone has anxiety, or if that anxiety is related to body image, right? So I used my academic background, my PhD work of understanding how to use data to inform treatment. And I built that into the app. And there's just some really warm messaging in there. I like to think of it as a big hug, but it is essentially a new framework. It's not like, oh, I'm doing things that have already been done. I mean, there's a hunger fullness scale in there. There's some tried and true things that work really, really well. But a lot of it is, you know, my new ideas that I developed from 11 years of working one-on-one with people. And it is a new message, and it is the message of nutrition for mental health, which really is three areas: nutrients that affect gut health and brain health. It's the gut brain access, right? Fostering a healthy ecosystem in our GI tract. And then it's all the cognitive processes around food, you know, flexibility, rigidity, rules, principles, body image, the role of stress, trauma, and adversity, all of the other factors that are contextual that contribute to our eating. And it's very, very much an agnostic approach, which means that I'm not pushing any agendas. There's nothing in there that would be like highly, highly biased. And it's like you pointed to, it's like you want a meal plan. You create it based on your values. I'm going to give you the ways of thinking, and I'm going to give you the framework. You create, you set your intentions, you do the assignments. And as someone does the assignments over 6 weeks, at the end of the program, they're able to collectively have this plan that they created. So it's basically a create your own meal plan journey. And then the coolest part is that we check in with mental health scores again.
That's awesome.
And one can see how their mental health scores may have changed, hopefully improved over the journey.
That's so cool. Yeah. I've actually, for those that are listening, we talk about the empowered eating model, which is the model I work under. And I won a free subscription to your app, which was super cool at our last professional conference. And it's totally in alignment with what we talk about on this show. So if anyone listening is curious about diving into that, I will make sure and link all that in the show notes so you guys can find it real easily. And then also I'll link information to Dr. Wiss's webpage and his private practice. So very cool work. I hope this isn't the last of our conversations. Thank you so much for being here today,
You're
David.
You're so welcome. Let's to be continued.
Yes.
Gosh, I'm so glad you joined me today. If today encouraged you, would you take a minute and encourage me by leaving a review for the show? I read every single one of these reviews, and your words, they mean so much to me. This podcast is here to support you weekly, but it only scratches the surface. To learn more on how you can become an empowered eater, snag my free workshop, How to Eat Intuitively and Hit Your Goals Without Obsessing Over Food, at jessbrownrd.com. Don't forget to join me right here next Monday, where I cannot wait to fuel your awesome. Cheers, my sweet friend, and happy eating. Thank you.